Hello and welcome to the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. Today we are joined by Carl.
Hello.
And we are going to discuss liberalism and whether it is salvageable. I think it is, and that it's valuable to defend it. And
I'll take the counter position on that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, what's not to love? You will listen to us talking about the man is naturally free position, individual rights, the social contract, autonomy, and the relation between liberalism and conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you think of the notion of liberalism, what do you have in mind?
So to me, it is the rationalistic philosophy that emerged from England at the beginning of the Enlightenment that begins, has its roots in, I would say, Thomas Hobbes through to Locke, has its most aggressive expression in the American Republic and most successful expression before being adopted by the French and imposed on the continent by the French Revolution, which takes it to an extreme that I think it has trouble escaping. And we can talk about that, why that is. And in the intervening years from, say, Napoleon to now, there's been a sort of long poisoning of our civilization due to extreme interpretations of liberalism that the moderate interpretations have real trouble resisting, because essentially they have to frame themselves as hypocrites in order to try and stem the flow of liberalism. And so, and the one of the reasons we're so vulnerable to liberalism as well is because, as Oakeshott would have said, it's the distillation of English political tradition into a doctrine. And so it's very difficult for the people whose tradition it is that has been distilled to resist it on its own grounds, because actually it's saying, no, these things that you agree with are correct. We're going to take them to the nth degree. And the problem with that is that there are loads of other considerations to, say, individual rights or personal liberty or sovereignty or whatever it is, or, you know, autonomy, all of these concepts that they existed in English political philosophy for centuries, long before liberalism, and the rights of Englishmen, which is what the rights of man are based on. But there is also a kind of aesthetic layer, a moral layer that attaches to these. And when you distill the doctrine away from that, you lose all of the other thick attachments that made it particular and parochial, which is what prevented it from destroying the country it came from.
Okay. I see. I think that when I am going to be defending liberalism, I'm not going to be defending liberalism in all its forms.
Sure, sure.
So I think it is very important to discern between a more Platonist and a more Aristotelian approach to terms. I think that the Platonist approach is a bit difficult and it doesn't give us good results. The Aristotelian one is a bit better. Now, let me be a bit clear about what that is. You constantly see Plato in the early dialogues asking, what is virtue? What is courage? What is temperance? As if it's supposed to be one thing and one thing only. That's the form. Aristotle says, don't look that way. There are kinds of things. So when you take the notion of freedom, for instance, there are kinds of freedom. I think that that's the approach I'm taking.
And that's a very, very clever way of defending liberalism. But the problem I think you have is that there's a philosopher called Claire Chambers who examined what she distinguished between two kinds of liberalism. She said that there's political liberalism and there's comprehensive liberalism. And so political liberalism deals with the individual's relationship with the state. So it's a political doctrine couched in legal terms about a set of enunciated rights and limitations of the state. And that I could commit to, right? Because obviously, why wouldn't you? That's what we'd call classical liberalism. But what on the transverse of that, you have what she calls comprehensive liberalism, which is taking those same values and applying them to every aspect of life. And so she essentially nails the liberal, as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to do a stream on this at some point, talking through her position in detail. But to summarize, she's essentially charging the political liberal with hypocrisy, because the political liberal will claim to be a liberal and yet be in defense of illiberal ways of life for example, a nunnery or something where women's rights and personal liberties don't exist, and the political liberal say, no, that's fine for that to exist because that's not to do with the state. And the comprehensive liberal says, but it is illiberal. And the political liberal has to kind of go, well, yeah, but I just think we should stop here for some reason.
I think we should draw a distinction between versions of political liberalism or kinds of political mm-hmm. liberalism. That's how I'm going to be.
Okay.
Not dodging the question. I think I am doing something, but I'm sure that you may see this as dodging the question.
No. I'm not going to say you're dodging the question, but I do feel the comprehensive liberal will be able to pin you on no matter what kind of liberalism you have. Because essentially, because it's not comprehensive, they're going to say, well, you're permitting illiberalism. Why? You're not really
I don't
liberal.
Think that the idea in political liberalism, not the Rawlsian view, mm-hmm. which is ever since the early 90s understood as political liberalism, or that's what most people think yeah. and associate with it. But with the tradition, as you say, yes, I do agree that there is a sort of political liberalism that I have in mind. I think that basically this is a Rousseauian thing to say to a classical liberal.
It totally
and,
is.
And it is the Rousseauian who charges the political liberal with hypocrisy
yes.
because the political liberal does not equate law with morality. So you could say that according to a classical liberal perspective, mm-hmm. the price of freedom is eternal vigilance mm-hmm. and the acceptance that some people are not going to live the way you do, you like them to.
The problem I think there though is that the charge of hypocrisy hasn't been refuted. And so the Rousseauian liberal can essentially claim to be the real and true liberal yeah. and say, you're not really a liberal. You're just pretending to be a liberal. And so any undecided, casual thinkers on the subject will have to come to the conclusion that they're correct, actually.
I think that this does not have to be the case because that would be conceding too much ground to the Rousseauian. So for me, I do think we should definitely talk about Rousseau.
Sorry,
and the social
contract. I'll let you get on with
No, but just to say something in advance, that I think that when Rousseau comes and puts his philosophy forth and mm-hmm. Rousseauians try to defend their philosophy, the proper way to respond to them, I think, is not to give them the term liberty, to question it on them.
But the thing is, they, in a sense, they are promoting the most radical form of liberty, which is total atomization and the breaking of all bonds from all individuals in a society. So, I mean, I don't have to agree with it. Obviously, I think that's a terrible idea. But like, yeah. in the context, in the frame that they're operating within, they have, again, just upped the ante. And so they make the other liberals seem as if they don't care, or they're not capable, or they're stupid, or they're sluggish, or they're just generally not being sincere in what they're advocating.
I understand this, but I think that I could answer to this objection by the mm-hmm. philosopher you mentioned by saying that, yes, of course, because the classical liberal, or from the perspective mm. of a classical liberal, there may be law and morality may be sometimes different.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be very much skeptical of those who pose as moral authorities about the good. And it's not so much the idea that we need to embrace just one view of the good life, but the idea that we should be skeptical of authority with respect to moral, and we should give freedom to people in order to pursue their idea of the good life themselves, provided that they respect some rights of liberty for everyone else.
See, now this is where I think that the classical liberal has the disadvantage over the Rousseauian liberal, because the classical liberal has an entirely negative doctrine. And so he can't actually lean on his doctrine and say, this will provide the good life, right? He's actually outsourced that to other conceptions of life. Whereas the Rousseauian liberal is advancing a positive doctrine that says, no, this will be the good life, to have no connections, to be a mere consumer, to be someone who is free to follow whatever whim fate puts in your mind at that time. That is the good life. And so, again, you've got this position where the classical liberal doctrine has a profound weakness within it and actually relies on something else. And so the Rousseauian liberal can say, look, you're not really a liberal, right, actually. You know, you're actually this other thing. You know, you're really a conservative, which is kind of true.
I think that there may be a way of answering this, because mm-hmm. I do accept that there is a weakness there with respect to action guidance. I agree with you there. Mm. There are things that if we try to create a sort of liberal morality, I'm skeptical of that.
Yeah.
And I agree with you there 100%. But I think that there is no charge of hypocrisy there, because hypocrisy would be if the political liberal or the classical liberal would sort of say that, no, I am putting forward the doctrine of the good life. But it seems to me that the classical liberal is saying that we should put have some rights. Mm. We should have liberalism as a guarantor of sort of legal framework within which we can coexist. But then individuals themselves will have to think about their own view of the moral life. And it is civil society that is going to be the main actor in...
So the the comprehensive liberal, the Rousseauian liberal, can say, well, no, actually, because you start on a certain set of premises. And from these premises, you are unwilling to draw the correct and logical conclusions, which is why I've arrived at the Rousseauian position and you're on the Lockean position. And that actually, because I mean, Locke, honestly, I think you could charge Locke with hypocrisy, actually. He definitely straddles the boundary between sort of a conservative traditional view and the liberal view, and clearly doesn't want to go full spectrum liberalism. And so the hypocrisy is in holding the assumptions that underpin liberalism, but not actually letting those bloom into what they should or, you know, logically would become under the Rousseauian framework. And that's the charge of hypocrisy. And so to say, oh, I'm a liberal, but I'm going to permit all this liberalism because I'm not really going to be a liberal, is what the Rousseauian will charge hypocrisy on. And I honestly, I don't think they're wrong there, right? And that's why I'm like, okay, well, I just don't want what they want. So I'm going to have to... But another thing as well, right? Okay, so if we just want a legal doctrine that guarantees certain rights, well, we have that without being liberals, right? We had that as the rights of Englishmen before liberalism was a thing. And so why can we not adopt a different perspective on the world and just drop the word liberalism? Even that, you know, that doesn't, liberalism doesn't have a sole claim to rights and freedoms and legal protections and things like that. It doesn't have the sole claim to that. And even if it did, we could still make a new doctrine that had a claim to these things as a core part of its own belief system.
I do see the point. My answer would be, however good that would be, is that there is immense power in symbolism. Mm-hmm. And I think that the symbol of liberty should not be given away to Rousseauians and aspiring bureaucrats,
but I don't
paternalists and tyrants.
But I don't think they have the sole monopoly on the concept of liberty. I don't think liberalism has the sole concept, monopoly on the concept of liberty.
No, I agree with this. I agree with this. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would be a good idea if now we mentioned some notions of liberty to put forward, so we...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
We sort of structure it because...
Sorry, I realize I derailed this
No. I mean, it's a freestyle symposium. Well, it's really nice. Mm. But I think that it's, I agree with you. There is liberalism, classical liberalism does not have the monopoly on the idea of liberty. Mm. Now, the way I see it, liberalism is broadly speaking a kind of tradition that says that liberty is a supreme political value. And there are many ways in which we could distinguish kinds of liberty and liberalism if we ask two questions. At least. There are more, but let's keep it simple. Mm-hmm. One question is, when we say that liberty is supposed to be a supreme moral value, there's a big question. Is it supposed to be the only supreme moral political value? Mm. Or is it one among many? Mm. If we accept the first position, which would be a bit more, you could say, hardline position and a bit more ideological, we have the sort of monistic liberal. Classical liberal. If we accept the latter position that liberty is a supreme moral, a supreme political value, but it is one among many others, we become what Isaiah Berlin would call a value pluralist classical liberal or value pluralist liberal. Mm. And there's these are two distinctions. And there's another thing to be asked is that it comes exactly from the question you asked. What is liberty?
So I think that there isn't a version of liberalism that actually only believes in liberty, because baked into the prior assumptions of liberalism is smuggled in the concept of equality and sameness and universality and interchangeability. And so the concept of equality is also a core part of liberalism. And of course, this is a contradictive dichotomy that liberty and equality have. If we're all free, we can't be equal. If we're all equal, we can't be free. But it does lay on the same foundation that it suggests that we have to be, and that it's just not right.
But couldn't we ask what sort of equality we're talking about? Because, for instance, I would agree with Nozick when he criticizes roles, when he talks about justice as being a non-patterned principle, when he says that you cannot simultaneously be pro-freedom and pro, for instance, equality of results. So you would need... Rawls was not in favor of equality of results, but the point is regardless that a sort of state that would need to guard against equality of results would be against equality of opportunity, for instance, or equality of freedoms would be, would require massive redistribution policies and would interfere. But what if we said that, you know, we should have equality of rights, equality of rights to freedom?
So the I think the issue is actually not about equality of results. The issue is about equality of origin.
Okay.
That is the presupposition of liberalism. All liberal thinkers try to boil down to a universal man who existed in the state of nature, who is essentially functionally interchangeable and indistinguishable from any other man, right? That's not true. Because it comes from the liberal belief that man is born free, which is also not true. And this is a complex web of false assumptions that has infused all liberal thought. I mean, you can read any of it. And I was listening to the audiobook of Utilitarianism just on the way in. And yeah, I've got so many problems with utilitarianism. See. But you can tell that Mill, his constituency is all mankind. And he thinks of them, he doesn't say it explicitly, but to arrive at any of his positions, he begins with all men originate from the same place. And it's just not true. And I don't mean geographically or physically even, I mean socially, right? The problem with liberalism is that it imagines man devoid of social bonds when he is born into the world, which he is not. He's born to a particular mother and father in a particular community with a particular family, with all of these very, very complex relationships. And nobody is devoid of those things. And those people that are in the single worst position a human being can be in, right? Okay. A total orphan, right? And so there is no such thing as equality at all. And liberalism presupposes it. And so from this point, you end up with a bunch of really confused claims to liberty and right, which, I mean, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean, right?
Okay.
I
will defend them.
Yeah. Sure, but like on every point, you're not really at liberty to just like to have liberty for its own sake, right? No, you have an obligation to your mum. Right, your mum wants you to go pick up the groceries. Okay, but I don't want to. Yeah, but you don't have a choice. You have an obligation here, right?
Yeah, but now we switched from political liberty to freedom from a particular moral obligation.
Yeah, but they're all bound up. That's the thing. Like your political obligations. Like this is the problem with, honestly, the entire Enlightenment. The idea that you can distinguish these things. No, you are at the same time a citizen. You have a political obligation to your state at the same time that you have a moral obligation to your mum to go and help her with her baggage or whatever, right? And so this thinning out of a person is just the wrong way to look at all of this. And so I've got this really full-spectrum complaint about liberalism at this point.
I agree with you there. But I don't think that it compromises all forms of liberalism. I do think that it does compromise forms of liberalism that have an ideal of radical autonomy. Mm-hmm. And they sort of say that you can choose morality or that something is moral because you choose it. I completely disagree with it. I think that's detestable and complete. There's nothing to debate there.
But I mean, even on terms of sort of moderate autonomy, I don't really think you do. Actually, you know, you're not really autonomous, you know, and it, like when someone, you know, You're an individual decision-making person, yes, but you've got this thick layer of obligations that you have to meet every single day. And not just for yourself, but for other people. And so in what way are you really autonomous?
Because I think that there are two notions of freedom here that are distinct. One is freedom to act without being coerced. And the other is freedom from obligations, from moral obligations. So I think we can definitely say that we are not free from moral obligations. Mm-hmm. But the question as to whether we are free to act or not is open.
I think you are free to act, though. And yeah. I think that, I mean, if we were living in the Soviet Union, maybe this would be a more pressing issue. But, I mean, you know, there are non-liberal societies in Africa where people are free to act.
Okay.
You know, like, everyone's free to act to a certain degree. The question is the constraints in which you're prevented from acting in certain ways. And, again, this is not purely the vocation of liberalism, right?
Okay.
Non-liberals have been arguing this as well. So,
yeah.
All I can see, you've got this philosophy that is very easily transformed into a full spectrum, comprehensive doctrine that destroys everything about civilization because it applies a standard to it that the civilization obviously couldn't hold up to and on the grounds of this abstract standard. Or you can just be something else, right?
I want to say that towards the end, I think we should reserve the question as to whether this is something unique to liberalism or it's a feature of all theories.
I think it's a feature of all Enlightenment ideology.
Okay.
I think they're all wrong on the same grounds on that. But anyway, so I'll let you
go. But just one thing to end with a classification of versions of liberalism. So if we say that liberalism is, broadly speaking, the position that promotes liberty, political liberty.
But also equality. It definitely promotes equality as well.
Equality of rights to liberty.
Sure, but there's still a fundamental equality of right there, right? And again, this is a major problem for me because we now see, like the Biden administration saying, well, children are equally free as their parents. Like, no, my children are not free. My children are not free and they don't not need to be free and it'd be bad for them to be free.
But they're not free. No, I think that, okay, let's say this because I think the point that man is naturally free can be defended in another angle.
Okay.
That's what, let's...
Yeah, okay.
No, let's keep the hype.
Let's keep the faith.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So if you can watch Symposium 2 we did with Bo on negative, positive, and Republican liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And these are three very major traditions that try to portray what political liberty is supposed to be about. So for instance, negative liberty is supposed to be in the Hobbesian view, it's supposed to be freedom from actual interference.
Mm-hmm.
In Isaiah Berlin's modified view, because he initially agreed with Hobbes, political negative liberty is freedom from actual interference by others, but also from potential interference by others and from potential deliberate coercion by others. Positive freedom is the idea that freedom consists in rational self-mastery or rational autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And here is where Rousseau is basically hanging.
Mm.
And the Republican tradition understands freedom as non-domination, the idea of lacking a master, not being subject to the arbitrary whim of someone.
Mm-hmm.
And at Symposium 2, we end with by saying that basically a more sophisticated defense of freedom needs a combination of all three. Because all three in isolation have some problems. But, you know, maybe you disagree on this.
I'll just let that one go for now.
Okay. And final thing, there is a distinction that is now prevalent between perfectionist liberalism that is associated with Joseph Ross and Stephen Wall and political liberalism that is mostly associated with John Rawls.
Mm.
And perfectionist liberalism is a doctrine that they will be exploring in the future because I think it's fascinating. And it tries to draw connection with liberty and the good life.
Mm.
And their perfectionists are arguing that, in a way, the good life, the state should promote the good life in the Aristotelian manner, but the good life requires respect of, requires autonomy. And the political liberalism is, broadly speaking, what we said in the beginning. So there are many kinds of liberalism. And when we talk about it, We shouldn't just think that all of them are ones. And two things to say. Mm-hmm. There was this trend in British idealism with Green, Boson, Kett, and not Bradley. Bradley was conservative. To talk about the sort, they sort of developed the new liberalism, where they had a view of autonomy that is a, that requires a bit more state intervention. Mm-hmm. And that basically was a bit more received, was treated as received wisdom in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. although in a non-idealist mantle. And now we have modern liberalism, which I think it's a disaster.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I won't be defending modern liberalism.
The Rousseauians won the argument. That's the thing. They won the argument by upping the ante, by saying, well, look, if you are for autonomy, if you're for freedom, if you're for equality, then not having access to certain resources inhibits your autonomy, and the social bonds that connect us inhibit your liberty. And if you care about those two values, then the liberal has to kind of concede that the Rousseauians have the real kind of liberalism.
I think,
despite the negative,
I think not, because it's one thing to say that we could be giving a sort of universal basic income, mm-hmm. and quite another to go full Rousseauian and equality of resources.
Well, Rousseau wasn't for equality of resources. He was for in a sense, he was for a kind of general equality of resources, where everyone would be essentially a small holding farmer, yeah. and unable to own enough that another man could rent from him, basically.
Do you hate his phrase that man is born free, but everywhere he's in chains?
No, I think it's very poetic, actually. Okay. And I think it's just totally wrong. I think that man's born in chains and then becomes free from his actions.
Okay, so because I don't like Rousseau's position, I will sort of appeal to a more Lockean sense.
That's fine.
Who I like a lot. And talk about the doctrine of man is naturally free. Would you be willing to concede that to me?
No.
The rephrasing. No, it's the same sentence and the same meaning.
Again, nobody is born free. That's the problem. Okay. I mean, in a literal sense, you literally can't do anything.
No, I'm saying whether you agree with calling it that way, man is naturally free, the doctrine.
I don't think, like, the problem is when we say free, the liberals mean it in both the political and the social sense. And you can understand it because in the 16th and 17th centuries and the 18th centuries, there were social ranks which we have trouble conceiving of now.
Yeah.
And we don't understand what it means to be born to a rank. And we've got a holdover of this in the British class system, but in everywhere in Europe was very cloying, heavy society that weighed on everyone. And a person's rank was self-evident from what they were wearing. This is why people don't seem to understand that being the butler of a nobleman was a very prestigious thing, because it gave you a social rank that was way above a commoner. And so the butler would have been wearing a nice suit. He would have been well-fed. He would have been in a stately home. And he was not of the same social rank as the commoners who would aspire to become butlers, right? And this, when the early liberals are talking about being born free, they don't mean being born away from state interference, because the state was very weak in this period of time. There's very, very little in the way of, you know, interacting with the state as we understand it in the sort of 20th century sense of the term. And so when they say free and everywhere is in chains, the chains are the bonds of society, the social ranks that hold things in place. And I can see why they would want to weaken these. But the problem with weakening these is that they have no ability to say, this is why we need them, right? Because okay. this is the thing they were attacking. And so now we can see all of these bonds of social rank and obligation are essentially dissolved at this point. They're completely dissolved. And we live on this kind of legacy love and sentiment between our families. And if you're lucky enough to live in a sort of homogenous local community, then you feel personal obligation. But there's no socially enforced rank there. There's no legally enforced rank there. There's nothing that actually binds this together in a more concrete way than other than sentiment. And liberalism simply can't provide that. And it has become the thing that has undermined it. And so this is why we need to start thinking about something else, in my opinion.
Okay.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.